Marv and Mike were very good, even in this first season of NBC commentary. They came out with some great gems back and forwards throughout this game, actually.
It's funny that you bring that up. McHale makes a three-pointer late in the game. It bounces on the rim about 16,000 times.
Which is a lot.
Which is a lot, yeah. I believe he quoted Xander Hollander. He said that McHale's discovered the joys of the three-point shot, and I've actually found it here. We know how Marv actually did his research. If we just go to page 59 of the 1991 Pro Basketball Almanac, has discovered the joys of three-point shooting last season. And if you guys watch the tape, Marv actually quoted it word for word.
So Marv, obviously an avid reader of the annual
An avid almanac. Reader, as we all were.
That's fantastic.
Then you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Takes it off and there's number 23. And of course, Johnny goes nuts.
So we're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Grant, you made the pass, yes. Christian, can you catch the ball, yes.
All the stars were aligned and all the muscles fired at the right time and I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 61. Thanks for joining me. Stay up to date with my monthly email newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming podcast episodes, future high-profile guests to appear on the show, and much more. Simply visit inallairness.com/news. Today, I welcome great mates of mine, Aaron Steen and Todd Spear. We discuss a classic double overtime game featuring Michael Jordan and Larry Bird, March the 31st of 1991. The visiting Bulls played the Celtics at Boston Garden. Both teams were having a great season and the playoffs were fast approaching. This is the edited audio-only version of a conversation we recorded live as a Google Hangout on August the 20th, 2015. Towards the end of the episode, I'll share a podcast review with a difference. Add yours by visiting inallairness.com/review. Show notes for this episode, including links to numerous topics covered, and of course the video chat itself, are at inallairness.com/61. Now, onto the show. Today, in person, Todd and Aaron, you're together there in Melbourne. Thanks for joining me as we're about to chat about a great matchup between the Chicago Bulls and the Boston Celtics from March of 1991. How are we, guys?
Doing very well.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Giggling like schoolgirls before we even get going. So a sign of things to come, I'm sure. Today's game, guys, that we're going to be chatting about took place on March the 31st in 1991 at the Boston Garden in front of a sellout crowd. 14,890 is the official crowd there. And it's an NBC telecast. It's a classic double overtime game between the Bulls and the Celtics. An NBC telecast led by the great Marv Albert and the czar of the telestrator, Mike Fratello. Any quick thoughts, and Todd, particularly, perhaps you might have a little bit of background here. This was the first season that the NBA was on NBC, so you got a couple of opening thoughts there about the coverage back in the early 1990s?
Yeah, for sure, Adam. It was the 18th game broadcast that year, fifth for Chicago, fifth for Boston. And obviously CBS had housed national television rights throughout the 80s. As we all witnessed later on, NBC set the standard for how games are broadcast, so Bird versus Jordan probably drew in a bit of an audience.
One of the first images that you see on the broadcast is the camera shot from the rafters in Boston Garden. So you see the parquet, you see all seats in the lower levels, and it's just, as far as NBA basketball goes, it's just one of the most beautiful things that you'll ever see. Yeah.
It was indeed. Now, the coaches for each team, the Celtics were led by Chris Ford and the Bulls were led by Phil Jackson. And just a few stats and facts and figures before we get going. The Celtics were 31-4 at home entering this game. And it's a period of time where numerous observers had all but written off the big three of Bird, McHale and Parrish. However, they were having a great season as a team and they were right in contention here for the Eastern Conference title. They won the Atlantic Division in this season, so clearly they've written off a little bit too early. And Todd, I know that you're a massive fan of the Boston Celtics, so I'm sure you could speak about the exploits of the Celts.
Yeah, well, they started the year 28-5, and obviously Bird's health dictated their record the rest of the way, but they started the season a lot better than Chicago. As a matter of fact, they beat them maybe the second or third game of the year in a very, very good game in Chicago.
but there's a Brian Shaw.
Brian Shaw. Jordan, yeah, missed the box out at the end, and Brian Shaw snuck in for the game winner. Boston was really good that year. They'd revamped their team. Jimmy Rogers in 1990, the team looked old. You know, they looked really bad. They lost in the first round in New York. So they brought some youth in. Brian Shaw had his second turn with Boston. He'd been in Europe for a year. D. Brown was drafted. Kevin Gamble was featured more. Reggie Lewis, of course, coming into his own. He'd really developed in 89 when Bird played only six games when he had double Achilles surgery. So it was really like they made a decision not to trade Parrish, not to trade McHale. Obviously, they were never going to trade Bird, but it was a nice, cross-pollination, so to speak.
Injection.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. And they ran a lot more than they did, you know, probably since the mid-80s. In many ways, Bird was just as much fun to watch as an older player as he was in his prime because he, obviously he was getting by on his guile, but he was, very, very sneaky, lived on the right side of the floor, used his hip more. He was just posted up more, but he best passing years for his last 3 years in the league. He was a lot of fun to watch.
You have those guys who are, as they get older, if their skills fade, if they have a jump shot still, they're still pretty relevant in the game. But Larry, he had a jump shot, but he was probably one of the smartest guys ever to play the game. So it was like watching MJ. Apparently, he played a season or two in Washington at one point in time. And you watch those games and, it's MJ without that quick first step and without the jumping ability, but it was still MJ. He still had the smarts, and Larry was the exact same thing in this game. It was slowed. I mean, he wasn't that quick in the first place, but it was slow, but it was just so good to watch in this game.
You know, just to draw off that idea, when you bring up the Wizards, the fear factor was still there.
Yeah.
You know, within that aged body, Bird was the same. You know, he still got double teamed. It was still Jordan. It was still Bird. You know what I mean? In 91, even though he was probably more streaky than he'd ever been, and as you guys saw from this game, there was still times where he was still Bird.
Plenty of good things there in terms of the Celtics, even though they were getting towards the end of that big three run. In terms of the Bulls, the 91 Bulls, they only used three starting lineups the entire regular season. And all these stats are, of course, courtesy of the great basketballreference.com. 73 times, it was a combination of John Paxson, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Horace Grant, and Bill Cartwright. And then six times, they went with Stacey King ahead of Horace Grant. And the other three occasions, Will Perdue started ahead of Bill Cartwright. Now, just 2 days before this game, it was mentioned that the Celtics clinched the Atlantic Division title. So they're on a bit of a high there as they enter this game at Boston Garden. So without further ado, guys, we might as well just get straight into the first quarter. Kevin Gamble, who you mentioned a bit earlier, Todd, he scored on the game's first basket. And in my notes here, for some reason, I've just written down to remind myself this was peak Gamble. I really enjoyed watching Kevin Gamble play, particularly in this early 90s phase of his career. He had career highs in points of about 15.5 a game, three assists and just over one steal per contest as well. So some good times there, and it was great fun watching Kevin Gamble.
Kevin Gamble was the small forward in my favourite role players of all time NBA team. Loved his jump shot. Had one of the sweetest looking jump shots ever.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Aaron and I were talking about it off camera. He was a low maintenance player. Didn't need the ball. You know, he was there to step into his jump shot.
Good role player.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like the perfect player for a passing team like Boston. Complimented Bird very well on the front court.
Early in this first quarter, Marv Albert was talking about the so-called mystique of Boston Garden, and he said it was a very quiet crowd that'll get into it in spurts. And then not long after, NBC flashed up a stat on the screen about Larry Bird's previous five games. He struggled from the field to shooting about 34% and was just under 13 points a game, whereas his season average was close to 20. So Marv and Mike were very good, even in this first season of NBC commentary. They, of course, clicked pretty much immediately with the commentary, and they came out with some great gems back and forward throughout this game, actually.
Well, I've said about Kevin McHale.
Actually, it's funny that you bring that up. McHale makes a three-pointer late in the game. It bounces on the rim about 16,000 times.
Which is a lot.
Which is a lot, yeah. And I believe he quoted Xander Hollander. He said that McHale's discovered the joys of the three-point shot, and I've actually found it here. So I think we know how Marv actually did his research. If we just go to page 59 of the 1991 Pro Basketball Almanac, has discovered the joys of three-point shooting last season. And if you guys watch the tape, Marv actually quoted it word for word. So
So Marv, obviously an avid reader of the annual
almanac, as we all were.
That's fantastic. And this is why, Todd, one of the many reasons that you are just an NBA fiend, that the fact that you've actually referenced the fact that Marv referenced that. So well done to you.
I consider myself someone who knows his stuff when it comes to the NBA and the 80s and 90s NBA, but I'm getting quite the education here at the moment.
No, not at all,
mate. No, I am, seriously.
Oh, well. That's the era we grew up in.
It is. And speaking of Marv, he came out with another great quote that I actually jotted down as well. It was in relation to Horace Grant. He said, Horace has given himself a new upper body this season. Horace having been the pride and joy of the Bulls strength and conditioning coach, Al Vermeil. I thought that was pretty funny as well. There was just a couple of great lines that they came out with throughout the call. And a bit later on as well, they actually talk about Mike McGee and his exploits of being able to guard Jordan better than most in the mid to late 80s. Now, Mike McGee played with the Lakers for about 5 seasons and then finished up with the Atlanta Hawks in 87 and 88, was playing under Mike Fratello. So I thought that was interesting to note as well, the fact that they said McGee guarded Jordan straight up pretty good.
One of the good things about having guys like Mike Fratello and Doug Collins on calls of games is that they would use their own experiences as head coaches in coaching guys like a Mike McGee. You get that insight into those guys that you wouldn't usually hear about. So,
not only that, it's probably a good segue into discussing the defense against Jordan in this particular game. Obviously, we've all seen Jordan play many, many times, but Reggie Lewis, for periods in this game, probably as good a defense as you'll see on Jordan as far as not only keeping him in front but also challenging his shot. Aaron and I were talking before, the amount of times that Jordan was forced to alter his shot was most unusual and probably speaks to the ability of Reggie. Like, it was just phenomenal.
They also spoke about the games that Jordan had against Boston up until this point in time. I think that he played pretty well in all of the games and scored a lot of points, which, again, was a bit hard to understand with the way that Reggie played him in the first half of this game.
Jordan connected on just his second field goal of the game inside the last 15 seconds of that first quarter. And then, speaking of Reggie Lewis, he hit a long two-pointer as time expired. So after one, the scores were tied at 28. Jordan had a very slow start, particularly in his first half. But as you said, Lewis was very good defensively, and I think he had 3 blocks on Jordan in this game. So, of course, defended him very well. Entering the second quarter, guys, Kevin McHale checked into the game after he missed six straight games prior to this with a sprained left ankle. And then he immediately had an impact by rejecting Scottie Pippen's strong drive to the hoop just within seconds of checking into the game. And I've got in my notes here, it was good news when Cliff Levingston was subbed into the game for the Bulls. That's a pretty poor joke there, but moving on.
It wouldn't be an In Orleans podcast without a pun.
Exactly. For better or worse. More into this second quarter, I've got here that Jordan connected on a strong driving layup and he got fouled and hit on the subsequent free throw. And then while at the free throw line, Marv mentioned that players around the league were becoming wary about being, and I quote, posterized by MJ. So there was talk of it even back then, the fact that pretty much at his athletic peak, or just probably past, I guess, in terms of his monster dunks, you don't want to be anywhere near the hoop as Jordan was on his way to throw down a monster jam.
Entirely possible that Marv invented the word on that very day. That's crazy. I don't remember hearing it back in that period of time.
I'm not sure actually when it first came out, so that's a good point. It might have actually came out around this time, but both Fratello and Marv were talking about how they were speaking with the players either the night before the game or during the practice the previous day as well. So I wonder what sort of access they actually had and just the informal comments and chats they were having with them just either before the media availability or whatever it was. So that was an interesting thing to note as well. Is there anything else from the second quarter that you guys wanted to make mention of?
You spoke about Kevin McHale and the fact that he missed a few games leading up to this one. They had a close-in shot of his ankle brace, which was, it appeared to be two enormous slabs of plastic attached to either side of his leg. So how he had any lateral movement at all on the court was just extraordinary. And that block that he had on Scotty just after checking into the game, it was a pretty amazing play considering how athletic Scotty was and how, like, essentially playing on one leg McHale was.
You know, it's funny. This is forgotten historically that McHale, throughout the 80s, would actually guard the opposition's most athletic front court player. So Wilkins, would be the most worthy. Aguirre, English, Stanley, you name it, because of the way, obviously Bird couldn't. The other thing about McHale, the previous month in Seattle, he rolled his ankle. Ever since he played on his broken foot in 87, his feet were never the same. But the injury he suffered in February 91 at Seattle, he was never the same after that. So we're basically watching incarnation of McHale that he had to adjust. Like you said, his feet were buggered. He was playing on one foot, basically. He was still very effective in the low post, though.
You see how much of a difference it was between later in his career, McHale, and it makes it all the more amazing that he used to guard those guys like Dominique and Worthy and Aguirre during the 80s. Like, yeah, it was all arms and legs, and, you know, like Phil Jackson, it looked like he had the coat hanger in his jacket still. Like, yeah, he's the broad shoulders on him, and the fact that he could stay with guys like that, I guess his long arms helped. The fact that he could stay through guys like Dominique is just, that's amazing.
And though his feet were not the same, one thing that was maintained was his love of grabbing a towel after every time he was fouled.
We talk about Kevin Garnett and his ritual of before the game. He'd go up and headbutt the basket support. McHale, every time there was a foul or a breaking play
anything.
He just walk up to under the hoop, grab a towel from the towel boy, I guess, under the hoop, and wipe himself down and throw the towel back every single time.
Whether he was fouled or not.
Whether he
was
fouled or not,
And he was an incredibly effective player, of course, as well, in terms of his on-court prowess, no doubt. Now, after starting the game with a really good field goal percentage, the Bulls were absolutely ST ruggling in the second quarter, and they shot just 33% late into this first half. And by the time we got to the first half, Boston had a 6-point lead. It was 53-47. Jordan had a really slow first half offensively, and due in no small part, I guess, to Reggie Lewis and some of the great D that was being played on him. He finished with 3 of 11 for the first half for just 7 points, and Chicago missed 11 of their last 12 field goal attempts, so they were stinking it up to no end. And Larry Legend had 14 points already by the first half, so he was in some good form after struggling in his previous 5 games.
Had a guy like Horace Grant, who was extremely athletic for a 6'10 power forward. Everyone always spoke about how fast and quick he was, and his wonderful new upper body that he had for the 1990-91 season. And he had a world of trouble guarding the aged Larry Bird in this game.
Completely agree with what Aaron said. There's a critical adjustment the Bulls make in the second half regarding Bird and how they defended him. And then later, obviously, in the second overtime, it flips back, and that probably ultimately turns the game.
Yeah, Bird had an absolute ripper of a second OT, and we'll get to that in the not-too-distant future. And entering the third quarter, the Bulls started with an 8-2 run. Pippen had a 3, Horace hit a turnaround in a lane, and then Johnny Paxson, who had a monster game himself, hit another 3-pointer. So that tied the game at 55 inside the first 90 seconds of this third quarter. Now, speaking of Paxson, a bit of research indicated that this actually was his career high for points in a single game. He had 28 points for the contest, and I was quite surprised to find that was his highest NBA scoring game ever. Were you guys aware of that?
No, I wasn't.
No, it felt like he had 48.
He was unconscious, and I then went to basketballreference.com, of course, and I had a bit more of a look into his stats, and I'll put the word only in inverted commas. He had only 20 games in his career where he scored 20 points or more, which I thought was rather interesting as well. I wish I could say something other than the word interesting, but he went 11 for 18 in this game and 5 of 5 from downtown. So he was crucial, and Pippen came through with some massive point contribution as well. But Johnny Paxson was definitely overlooked, but was great in this game. And of course, when it came to the 1991 playoffs and the finals particularly, he was an absolute force to be reckoned with as well.
I said to Todd before that Paxson finished along with Jordan in the top 20 in field goal percentage this season, I think. He shot around the 53% mark, and all of these games from this season you see him play, including this one, it looks like he shot about 83% from the field during that season. But his great shooting aside, how many shots were there that were made in this game that were helped by those Boston Garden rims?
Mm.
Those, yeah,
very friendly
shooting rims at the old Boston Garden.
Well, as you mentioned, one of McHale's shots bounced on the ring 16,000 times, so it was very friendly to the home team particularly.
You know, when talking about Paxson, there's a lineage there, isn't there? You've got Kyle Macy, you've got Hodges, particularly, 89 postseason when he when Jordan played the point guard. You've got Paxson, you've got Armstrong, you've got Kerr, you've got these guys who don't necessarily dribble. I suppose Macy would be an exception, who don't dribble, and they step into their shot. But it also speaks to our Jordan, the attention he commanded, you know, and obviously the ability to find those guys. But Paxson, just when you say he was 11 for 18, I'm surprised he missed seven shots, because he stepped into his shot, especially in the second half. Rhythm, you know, just crazy rhythm. He and Pippen just kept him in the game when Jordan was struggling early.
Jordan would have never been able to play against a prototypical point guard who had to have the ball in his hands all the time. I guess it was the bleeding obvious that he needed guys, you know, like a Paxson, Hodges and a Kerr to be able to play off the ball and spot up.
And he trusted Paxson.
Oh, he did, yeah.
Now, both teams began the third quarter on fire from the field, and that was a trend that would continue for the entire 12 minutes of this third quarter. After three, Boston held the lead 86-78, and the Bulls, they were really good from the field, 11 of 19 for 58%. However, the Celtics were unconscious, to steal a Marv Albert phrase, and went 16 of 22 for 73%. So, heading into the fourth quarter, all signs pointed to a Boston win, but it wasn't going to be quite that easy as a great fourth quarter was about to unfold.
And the lead extended. I think it got to 14 at one stage, and Boston had a great rhythm, especially in the half court. You know, most unusual that playing at home, crowd on their side, that you would have thought they would have, you know, at least finished it by 6 minutes to go, but Chicago had another run left.
They sure did. And in the fourth quarter, after they returned from a commercial break, I'm sure you guys probably saw this if you rewatched the game in the lead up to today's chat. Did you notice that Ahmad Rashad and then Marv and Mike were talking about a particular T-shirt that was on sale, which was a Yes and It Counts T-shirt?
Yeah. Immediately after watching the game, the first thing that I did was I jumped on eBay.
I'm not surprised.
Alas, I had no luck.
Tried to source one of those T-shirts. They'd be pretty hard to come by, but they looked pretty cool. And they showed one in the Celtics green and then in the Bulls red. So that was good to see those guys sporting those T-shirts. Now, as you mentioned, Todd, courtesy of a 10-2 run early in the fourth, the Celtics opened up their biggest lead of the game, an almost insurmountable 14 points. So it was 96-82, and there was about 9.5 minutes to go. And that was then on the back of a Kevin McHale three-point make that danced around the rim, possibly 16,000 times, before a leprechaun finally nudged it into the basket.
You know, McHale shot actually the same percentage on threes as Bird in 1990, if you can believe that. McHale, you know, his game took on another dimension, but when Chicago made their run, Jordan made a distinct change in his approach. He actually started coming at Lewis from the top, and he had a lot more success on the running start. There was one play where he went right to left and then ended up floating through the lane, was challenged by four Celtics. I think it was Pinckney, McHale and Bird. Made a phenomenal shot, just a, you know, probably only a shot that Jordan could make. And as I said, the running start seemed to free him up, get him a little bit more space against Reggie.
Yeah, after a very slow start in the first half, aided by some really good D by Reggie Lewis, of course, he was a completely different guy in the second half in the overtimes.
He was indeed. And then, as you said, Todd, the Bulls reeled off 8 straight points of their own, and that brought the game back to just a 6-point margin. In less than 2 minutes from having given up that game's largest lead of 14. Now, I've got in my notes here Scottie Pippen, and we mentioned him a little bit earlier. He had a few spectacular moves during this game, which goes without saying, but I've got that he was having a relatively quiet, almost 30-point game at this stage. He's, again, just flies under the radar because Jordan does all the spectacular things, of course, but Pippen was so athletic and such a handful offensively as well that on any other team, he could have perhaps lit it up for even more, you know, 4 or 5 points more a game, you'd have to imagine. So he was another key factor and continued to build his points per game as each season progressed from his rookie season too.
And it's something that we spoke about before we started recording today about how Scotty didn't make the All-Star team in 1991 after making it the previous year when the game was in Miami. The way that commentators often spoke about him during games in this season, yeah, it just adds to the wonderment of how he didn't make it in 91 as well.
The fun thing about watching Chicago from that era, we all know what they became, but you're seeing them evolve. Like, it's fun to watch Pippen, you know, come of age. And we were talking about it, you know, this might have been the best game of his career. No game stands out before then. You know, he played, you know, phenomenal on both ends. But not only that, you know, you look at, you know, Pippen's evolution. It started in moments like this. I think, you know, we all think of him from the end of his career, but there were doubts about whether, you know, he would be there when it counted. Obviously, the migraine the year before Game 7 at Detroit. There was even talk that Jordan, you know, didn't fully trust him until he'd proven himself on the biggest stage. But it's games like this where, you know, he earned his chops.
I've watched quite a bit of 89 and 90 Bulls playoff basketball just recently. And you see him even back in 1990, one season beforehand, and in particular in 89, he's just a completely different beast. Where you see those flashes of what we all knew him to eventually become, but he was still very tentative as well. But as you said, he evolved. And then in this 91 season, he really became that guy that, you know, just exploded, you know, after the other 91 finals. And in particular, how fast did his star rise in between the 1991 NBA finals and the start of the 91-92 season? He went from a very good player on the Bulls, you know, like a borderline all-star apparently in 1991, to a superstar, you know, at the start of the 91-92 season.
Well, like a dream teamer.
Dream teamer.
Like the dream team would have been named within that period of time.
Yeah.
Like it's quite amazing when you think about it.
Yeah.
He started most games for the dream team. Because talking about a 12-month period.
That guy who played in the 89 and 90 playoffs for the Bulls, that wasn't a dream teamer at all. He exploded. Not literally, of course.
No, we hope not. We hope not. And then I've also got here that following a great piece of Telestrator work from Mike Fratello, Marv came out with the following gem. He is, ladies and gentlemen, the czar of the Telestrator, an unbelievable man. That was one of his comments at one stage. So to say that they had a great chemistry early and often throughout the 91, which was their inaugural season, as far as the NBC telecast go, is an understatement. They were just fantastic to listen to. And is there anything you want to add about those two guys and the way they called a game, or do you want me just to move on?
Marv and Mike were the NBA and NBC, weren't they? If they didn't have, I mean, I think that the broadcast and the production of the games by NBC, I think, you know, it was like a step up from what you saw beforehand.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we needed a duo like those two guys to add to it.
And it's about this time that I'll have to enter into some shameless self-promotion. I'm sure you'll appreciate this, Aaron. InolAnders.com/32. That's when I actually had a chance to speak with the czar of the Telestrator. And that was a fantastic chat. Best part of an hour talking about his career, including coaching and whatnot, but obviously his NBC days as well. So moving back to the game itself before I derail us completely, the Bulls went ahead 108 to 107 and there was less than 2 minutes remaining in regulation. And that was Chicago's first lead since the second quarter. So they fought their way right back into the game. And the crowd was, of course, right into this contest. Both teams are obviously in the upper echelon of the Eastern Conference. Now, I must say at one stage late in this quarter, Ed Pinckney actually tackled Michael Jordan. He was isolated on a terrible matchup, so it was a bit of a mismatch. But then Marv said, Jordan strangled by Pinckney. And immediately I thought of the Boston Strangler. So hello to Andrew Tarney if you're listening.
He just logged in for the Google Hangout, Andrew Tarney. I just saw his name pop up.
Beautiful. I'll try and invite him into the chat. Just give me a second.
He'll be trending shortly. I thought Jordan actually did a good job of not blowing his stack at Pinckney.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was made to look worse by the fact that MJ, he ended up on his backside at the end of it. So, you know, if he had have kept his feet, it wouldn't have looked as bad. But well, you mentioned before, you're a shameless self-promotion, Adam. If you go to ignoreanus.com/52, you'll hear probably our finest episode speaking about our favourite commentators, Adam.
That episode took the best part of 10 hours to put together, and I'm not exaggerating, which is quite sad. But I think it's one of the best episodes for sure. A labor of love.
Yep.
And speaking of Ed Pinckney, guys, just for no apparent reason, in 1994, I was in Boston Garden, just to drop in a subtle sledge there to Aaron, who never actually got to go there before it was demolished. I saw Ed Pinckney just up in the cheap seats in the nosebleeds. He played, obviously, in that season for the Celtics, but he was in civilian clothes that day. He's a very big man. He's about 6'10", 6'11", every bit of it, and I was absolutely starstruck. I was about a meter away from him and completely lost for words for no apparent reason.
Yeah. That's one of the worst stories I've ever heard.
No jealousy whatsoever, surely.
None.
No, didn't think so. Now, moving back to this game, guys, Reggie Lewis hit what was incredibly his first three-pointer of the season that tied the game at 110 with less than 20 seconds left.
I find that very interesting. He had a very nice mid-range shot, not unlike Kevin Gamble, who didn't shoot threes either.
His form, though, Reggie Lewis's form was such that how do you describe it? It was a jump shot, but like his feet and his bottom half would kind of move in, and whilst his top half was moving backwards, it was a unique looking jump shot. And even though, you know, he didn't shoot many threes, he was deadly inside the 3-point line at 6'7". I've always loved big shooting guards, and I think MJ helped that along a little bit, you know, being 6'6", but Reggie at the 2 at 6'7" was just, it was unguardable at times with those really long arms on him.
One of my favorite moves an offensive player does is when they rip the ball through from left hip to right, and Reggie did it as good as anyone.
Brilliant.
Rip the ball through, one dribble, straight up.
A baseline fadeaway. Yeah. A baseline fadeaway where you take one dribble to his left and then pull up. It was just beautiful.
I actually make a statement here. I always thought the best defense I'd ever seen on Jordan was game 7 of the 90 Eastern Conference Finals. And I know Jordan had 31, but Dumars' position, he should show every kid how to play defense. I'll go as far as to say Lewis, for stretches in this game, was as good as I'd ever seen Jordan defended. And this, we're talking athletic Jordan. Obviously, you can probably talk maybe 96 finals, a different breed of Jordan against Gary Payton. But Reggie Lewis's position defense in this game was as good as I've ever seen.
Something that I've seen recently too, I mentioned before that I've watched some 89 and 90 Bulls playoff games, is there's a guy that I never really knew, you know, had this effect on MJ, but Trent Tucker played him pretty well too.
Did he really?
Yeah, during the 89 playoffs, you could tell that Trent really got under MJ's skin a little bit when he defended him, and that's something that, yeah, I never really knew of beforehand.
Then Mike McGee, apparently.
Apparently Mike McGee, yeah.
Hello to Mike McGee and Trent Tucker, if you're listening. Now, that series against the Knicks back in 89, that's one of the forgotten really good to great series. I actually love that series. A couple of fiery moments, of course, Kenny Walker and Scottie Pippen going at it as well, with Chuck Daly commentating, no less. That was quite interesting. But anyhow, moving on, I'm derailing ourselves a bit here, guys.
In 1991, we talk about the emergence of Scottie. I think it was in the first half of game one in their opening round series against New York. Scottie absolutely destroyed New York in the first half. I'm pretty sure it was game one or game two, but at both ends, I think he had about 19 points at the half, and he was just everywhere. And as I mentioned to you before, Todd, dunked on Patrick Ewing 200 times in the first half.
None of these are official, by the way. They are not courtesy of basketball.
No, reference. At all. No.
Pure speculation. Now, Chicago turned the ball over with about 3 seconds left, which gave Larry Bird a chance to win the game in regulation. And I have to say, it was very close to dropping in at the buzzer. The Leprechauns weren't on his side for once, but it was not to be. And then Marv Albert, I'm not sure if you guys picked up on this or not, but he actually said after that shot missed, they did not get the hop. Now, I don't know if there was any play on words intended there, because this game was played on Easter Sunday. Am I reading too much into this? He said hop and it was Easter Sunday, or should I just move on?
I didn't catch that.
That's all you, man.
Two things I want to add. Lewis face guarded Jordan on that last Chicago possession, which was incredible.
Yeah.
And then the second thing, probably the smartest defensive player I've ever seen, Scottie Pippen, left Larry Bird. He doubled McHale. Granted, McHale probably needed quadruple teaming. Left Larry Bird for the final shot.
Wide open. And as I said to you before, where you see that shooting form that far open, you'd write it in biro.
And Sam Smith made mention in the book, The Jordan Rules, that people who weren't supposed to care were upset that Bird had missed. And I think he was referencing Jackie McMullen and Peter May, who could be seen on the NBC cameras behind Chris Ford, ruining the missed shot by Bird. If you watch the replay, everybody wanted to go in. And as Sam Smith wrote, even the people who weren't supposed to care.
Really?
I love these sort of bits and pieces that you bring up, Todd. So thanks again for sharing these sort of intricacies, because I know that I enjoy them. I'm sure that everyone listening would enjoy hearing these sort of things too.
As coming up, Bird missed his shot, but Jordan made his maybe a hair too late.
He did at the end of the first overtime. We'll get to that in just a moment. Yeah, a hair. Well played. Interestingly, as the game went into overtime and the scores were 110 apiece after regulation, the Bulls had outscored the Celtics 32-24 in that last quarter. A little stat flashed up on the screen, and Marv mentioned that the Bulls were the NBA's only team to that point in the 1991 season to have not actually had an overtime game. So that was a good little tidbit there from marvellous Albert. But getting into the first overtime itself, the Celtics extended to a 5-point lead late in that first overtime after a Robert Parrish rainbow jumper in the lane. But then the next play down the floor, he fouled out of the contest. Chicago responded quickly. Jordan hit a couple of free throws, and then Johnny Paxson drilled a wide open three to tie the game at 118 with about 30 seconds left.
Robert, the Chief Parrish, was unguardable in that first overtime, didn't he?
And it was a good thing he fouled out for Chicago,
yeah,
wasn't it?
It was, because he was fantastic.
You could probably argue that they would have won in first overtime if Chief had stayed in.
And I think towards the very last part of that first overtime, and we might as well get to that right now, the refs waved off an incredible shot that Jordan made as he fell out of bounds. It was ruled rightfully so that it was a fraction late on his release, but he caught the inbounds pass with 0.4 of a second left. But the guy that was guarding the inbound pass was none other than, and I'll probably butcher the pronunciation here, Stojko Vrankovic. Did you notice that, guys?
I did indeed. Yeah. And I even checked the box score to see whether they actually, and yeah, they had him down as a minute.
Yeah. It registered.
I was thinking the same thing, Todd. I looked to see if it was classed as a minute or not because he was in there for 0.4 of a second, but I guess it has to be classed as at least a minute on the court, I suppose.
And Jordan caught that pass, was fading out of bounds into the Boston Celtics bench and drilled a three, which was ultimately waved off.
Great theatre, though, wasn't it? To see him then sort of bump into Chris Ford, and Ford tried to hang on to him for a second, and Jordan shrugged as if to say, why didn't it count? But I think he knew in his heart of hearts that it was a fraction too late. But fantastic theatre, and then we're heading to a second overtime. The game was tied at 118 after that first OT.
Just to, on that Jordan, great players, they have amnesia. And what I mean by that is Jordan completely forgot all the struggles he'd had offensively. And when there had to be one shot to be made, he made it. But terrific call without the benefit of replay that the correct call was made, that he didn't get it off. And, it was literally, if there was 0.5 of a second left, for example, probably would have counted. But
they showed a real-time replay too, didn't they? They had some slow-mos, and then they showed a real-time one. And, very good pickup by the ref to have to wave it off.
And you could see the ref closest to the ball, he was signalling definitely before the shot even went in that it was going to be a no score. So that was, great to see, particularly at that time before the advent of the heading to the monitors and checking back on the replays. So into the second overtime, Johnny Paxson hit on a very rare 4-point play, which got the margin back to just 2 points, but Boston would ultimately hold on and they won the game. Now, I think you were about to speak there, Aaron. Sorry, did I cut you off?
Sorry for speaking while you were interrupting.
So, it's one of my favourite lines.
You haven't mentioned how good rookie D Brown was in this game. The Bulls had a lot of trouble guarding him, because I think for the majority of the game, he had guys like Hodges and Paxson and whatnot guarding him, and it was obviously going to be a lot quicker than what they were. He had a really good game, and I also wanted to add in how much I loved his jump shot.
You know, it's unusual. Obviously, the iconic D Brown moment was the dunk comp, which he dunked left-handed, and not unlike Kendall Gill. You forget that he was right-handed because, you think of him dunking left-handed.
Mm.
Very short, very good from the mid-range in this game. Even had a couple of nice takes to the basket, finished in traffic. But he was one of those guys that gave Boston this new feel, like this more athletic, more exciting, quicker, really complimented the older guy as well.
I thought it was very cool also how in the 1991 dunk competition, how he's pumping up of his Omni-like Reeboks, how it was an original idea of his too, Adam.
Yeah, you've set me up beautifully there. I'll talk about very briefly. The previous guest on the podcast is Mr. Cedric Sabalas, who won the 92 dunk contest, and he has some very interesting comments to make about 1991 and actually where D. Brown, in fact, may have got a majority of his ideas for in terms of those creative dunks that a lot of people, pretty much everybody, has credited to D. Brown the entire time. But very recently, check back in the archive history of the In All Earnest podcast, and Cedric lifted the lid on the actual truth behind that. So that's a very good listen too, if I don't say so myself. And a quick shout out to Nathan Hand on Twitter at Handyman23. He's just thrown in a quick, the boys are all over it currently on YouTube, and he sent out a link as well with the Boston Celtics and Chicago Bulls logo. So thanks, Nathan, for interacting with the show. We didn't even really prepare and promote this episode in advance, so thanks very much for taking the time to do that without any notice. But getting back to the game itself, guys, it was a high-scoring second overtime period. The Bulls were outscored 17-14 by the Celtics. And as you mentioned earlier on near the start, Todd, Larry Bird connected on 4 of 5 shots in this final overtime session compared to Jordan, who went just 1 for 6. And Bird's efforts in this second OT are effectively what got Boston over the line and got them the victory.
And something very important happened to start the second overtime, Adam. Chris Ford went small and he went with 3 guards. And as a result, Pippen, who had guarded Bird basically on the most important possessions to that point, he actually was forced to move to one of the guards, and as a result, Grant went back to Bird, and I felt that that was probably the tactical decision that changed the game. And of course, all Bird needed was one shot to go down. It's funny, at that point in his career, there were moments where he was streaky. He could fade in and out of games. There was actually a game earlier that month in Utah. He had 10 points in the first quarter. Not sure if he scored a field goal again until overtime, made 4 field goals in overtime. You know, like I mentioned, the fear factor before, he wasn't Bird for the full 48 minutes. But when he needed to be Bird in this particular game, he still had it in him.
There were several times when he took the taller Horace Grant and the more athletic Horace Grant down to the low post, and he popped in one of those fadeaway jumpers that looked like they'd brushed the bottom of the banners, you know, up in the rafters at Boston Garden. But he just had that muscle memory and that ability. And as you mentioned, that hip.
His right hip.
Yeah, it was beautiful to watch.
And not only that, in the locker room afterwards, Pippen said to Grant, they shouldn't send a boy in to do a man's job.
Well, there's some great books that are written around this period of time that we're chatting about. And one of them we were talking about before we recorded this ep today, guys, was Unfinished Business by Jack McCallum. And that's definitely a great read, focusing on the 1991 Celtics particularly. So that's one of a number of books that definitely should be sourced and read at some stage if you haven't already checked it out.
Actually, both teams had books written about them in 1991.
Yes, of course, we've got the great Jordan Rules by Sam Smith, a former podcast guest on 2 occasions, dare I say. Hashtag shameless self-promotion. Now, the final score here, guys, in the game, Boston were 135 to 132 winners in double OT. And for what it's worth, this was almost a carbon copy of the final score from the famous 1986 playoffs, Game 2, which was also double overtime. And Boston won that match 135 to 131. So I just thought I'd throw that in there for no real reason except to say that it was close.
From either of you, any particular observation about the final possession? John Paxton, entirely possible, he might still be standing in Boston right now with his hands wide open. He was ready to step in.
Well, I think in the last 10 or so seconds of the game, Jordan had a couple of three-point attempts. He forced the second one. I think he said something like he didn't know how much time was left, but you're saying that Johnny Pax was all but asking for that last three-point attempt to possibly tie the game again, Todd?
Yeah, absolutely. And the way he was shooting.
Well, 5 of 5 at that stage.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be the only time in Jordan's career that perhaps there was another guy in a Bulls uniform on the court who was probably on a bit of a roll and probably more prepared to take the shot, a.k.a. a Tony Kukoc in Game 5, 1998.
When he had like 30-odd points, 31 points.
In Chicago, yeah. So I'm sure it wasn't the only time when he took the shot when he shouldn't have, but you know, it was MJ, so what are you going to do?
He made a couple.
Yeah, he made a few in his career. Now, Boston improved to 52-20 on the season after that victory, and the Bulls dropped to 53-18. They were still the number one seed in the East at that point. The Celtics went 4-6, including losing their final 4 games of the regular season, whilst the Bulls went 8-3 in their last 11 games of that regular season. Now, for Chicago, a few quick stats here. Jordan finished with 37 points. However, he shot just 33% from the field, 12 of 36. He had 7 boards and 9 assists, so he did pretty well overall. Scottie Pippen had an absolute monster game. He had 35 points, 10 rebounds and 9 assists, so almost a triple-double for Scottie. And Johnny Paxson, as we said, had a career-high 28. Horace Grant had 15 and 18 rebounds, so he brought the lunch pail to work at Boston Garden that day.
And some of those statistics, you know, Horace Grant, 15 points, 18 boards, and did we even discuss his impact other than his off-season workouts? Like, lots of layers for this game. I know, obviously, a long game, 58 minutes, but stats galore.
If you go back to the end of the 89-90 season and playoffs, Horace Grant actually looked a lot like Sean Bradley. And then Alvin Mile, during the off-season, he turned him into the – why is no one laughing? Alvin Mile actually turned him into the 6'10", 230-pound – Leviathan that he was in the 1991.
I was going to go with Hulk, but he's a Leviathan. Wow, that's awesome.
Hashtag Leviathan.
Yeah. Horace the Leviathan Grant from now on. Well done. Just quickly, guys, to wrap up the Boston stat lines, Larry Bird had 34 points. He struggled a bit from the field as well. He was 15 of 36, but also had 15 rebounds, 8 assists, and 3 blocks. So a fantastic effort from him. Reggie Lewis had a great game with 25 points and 4 blocks, I think 3 of which were on Michael Jordan. As you mentioned, Aaron, D. Brown had a great game. I think Marv Albert said his career high to that point in 1991 was 22 points. He finished with 21 points and had 7 assists. The Chief went for 15 points and 10 boards. Kevin Gamble had 12 points. Brian Shaw had 11 points and, importantly, 15 assists. And rounding things out, Kevin McHale had 10 points and 6 rebounds in his return. And Eddie Pinkney went for 7 points and 4 boards. Now, I think the only stats I haven't included there are probably Stojko Vankovic. And for what it's worth, he played 0.4 of a second.
1 minute in the game.
That's right. But, yeah, a fantastic contest, a double overtime thriller at Boston Garden, and only about 10 or 11 games out from the NBA playoffs happening in 1991.
Too bad we never got a playoff series out of those two. Yeah, at a more even, obviously 86 and 87, heavily favoured in Boston. If Boston had beaten Detroit in the conference semis, they could have had a conference finals against each other. Would have been interesting. I think the result was probably fairly obvious. After January of 91, Chicago's record was unbelievable.
That Pistons team in 91 was right for the picking too. Like,
very much so.
Atlanta had them down 2-1 in the first round of that series. So it's a wonder that Boston didn't make it through.
Yeah, well, Bird missed game one of that series because he basically shot every bullet he had in game five just to beat Indiana. And then went straight to hospital, spent the night in traction. So that's probably why.
That's probably a pretty good reason. That series, and in particular Game 5, Indiana and Boston of 1991, is an In All In Us podcast episode all to itself, especially Game 5. That was just an amazing game.
It is indeed, mate. You've set me up beautifully here by saying one of two things. First, Bob Hill, the Indiana coach, episode 14 of In All Earnest. So he was a former guest and talked about that to some extent. So thank you for reminding me there. And a future episode, which I'm keeping under wraps at the moment, will be focusing on that very series from 1991. So stay tuned for that. That's a bit of an exclusive, if you don't mind. Just talking about the 91 playoffs, that Boston-Detroit series, I think it went to 6 games as it was. So the Celtics almost took it to a full 7. So it would have been interesting had they actually progressed to then take on the Bulls come 1991 Eastern Conference Finals. But that's another what if for another time. So thank you, Aaron, and thank you, Todd, for being part of the show. Closing thoughts?
Yes, two things. It's an unconfirmed report that the D-Brand actually ripped off a half dozen or so of Cedric Ceballos' moves in this game. and secondly, you mentioned before that the Celtics lost their last 4 games of that season. What was that? You know why?
No, I don't, but I certainly believe
resting guys or?
Well, Bird only played 60 games in 91.
Yeah.
It was much the same in 92. Basically, his presence determined probably less in 92, but in 91 they were so reliant on him. If you just look at their record when he played, it's night and day. The first 3 months of the season were phenomenal for Boston, but they just ran out of legs, and probably a good thing they didn't play Chicago. It probably would have been a short series, but Bird's health, Larry sneezed, everyone caught a cold. So that's pretty much how it went.
Well, they couldn't have done any worse than what the Pistons did in the Eastern Conference Finals. True. So you might have given them more of a run for their money.
Yeah, 91 Bulls, clearly the best team. They would have beat Portland. Obviously, they beat LA. Yeah, superior team.
I think Bird came back from, he missed 6 or 7 of the last games in the regular season, but I think he played the final game of the regular season to then get into some sort of momentum leading up to the playoffs, but he didn't practice hardly at all with the team leading up to that first round series. But for now, we'll leave that there. Thank you guys for taking part of this. I really enjoyed chatting about the NBA history, of course, as you two do as well. So it goes without saying that we obviously enjoy any time we can get together and talk basketball. But for now, we'll leave it at that. And hopefully we'll do this again at some stage in the not too distant future. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure for you.
Always good, Mike.
All right, guys. Thank you. As usual, Aaron, you've got the last word. Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. Suggest topics or guests that you'd like to hear our conversations with. Leave a voicemail by simply visiting inallearnest.com/voice. Click start recording, leave your message and press stop. You can even listen back before submitting. press send, and you're done. Time to share another great review from a fan of the show. Thanks to Chelsea Man, who added a review on the USA iTunes store. It's titled, Yeah, with an exclamation mark, no less. And it reads, all... And that's it. Short and sweet. I can only assume that a great review was to follow, but it was submitted prematurely. Off to a great start there, Chelsea Man. And importantly, you did add a 5-star rating to the podcast, which is fantastic. So thanks very much for that. If you want to get in touch with me, by all means, please do, so I can read out the rest of what would have been your full review. Thanks again. Worldwide, the show currently has 55 reviews, 52 on iTunes and 3 on Stitcher. Thanks for your continued support. As always, if you add a review, I'd love to read it out on a future episode of the show. Your ratings and reviews are one of the best ways to support the podcast. If you enjoy the show, please do tell your basketball-loving friends about it. Your word-of-mouth recommendations are worth their weight in gold. You can subscribe to my show in various ways. iTunes, visit inallairness.com/review. Add it to your Stitcher playlist, inallairness.com/Stitcher. You can also subscribe on Pocket Casts, Player FM, TuneIn Radio, and other podcatchers. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show and share my web address with your friends and colleagues, inallairness.com. Check out the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with high-profile guests. Follow me on Twitter at InAllAnus. Please add your like to the show's social hub, facebook.com/InAllAnus. Join me next time for another edition of the show.